in New Orleans where everything is fine. All them cats is drinking that wine, drinking that mess.
I'm correspondent Tom Wilmer, reporting from downtown Paso Robles, California, at the New Hope on Park tasting room. Join us for a conversation with second-generation wine grower Austin Hope. Hope is the owner and winemaker at Hope Family Wines, which was named the American Winery of the Year by Wine Enthusiast magazine in 2022. Austin's namesake, Austin Hope Cabernet Sauvignon, is America's fastest-growing luxury Cabernet Sauvignon with distribution in 42 countries. In less than 10 years since its launch in 2017, Austin Hope Cabernet Sauvignon has grown to become one of the nation's best-selling luxury Cabernet Sauvignons. An under-the-radar aspect of Austin Hope's passion and philosophy is sustainable growing and producing of grapes and wine. Come along and join the conversation with Austin Hope.
If you want to get along, New Orleans town, buy some wine and pass it all around. Age runs up for tonight. All those cats, they love sweet wine. Drinking wine's for you to drink wine. Wine's for you to drink.
Here we go.
Okay,
here we are downtown Paso Robles, right off the park. Tasting room?
This is a whole new concept that we've created. We have our main tasting cellar is just off of 46 West, off of Arbor Road. It's 1585 Live Oak. That's where we've been for many years, but I've always had a dream to be downtown, be part of the community, be facing the park, which is the symbol of really this amazing little city we live in. And we had an opportunity to acquire a building downtown facing, so we're at 1140 Park Street. We decided to create the first ever sidewalk tasting bar.
So you ripped off the whole front wall of the building, didn't you?
Exactly. We ripped front of it off, opened it up so it's just a big bifold door opens up right to the sidewalk. And so people can just walk by and come in, grab a glass of wine, do a tasting, grab a wine to go, a wine cocktail to go. But more important, behind that is kind of behind the curtain, if you will, mm-hmm. our creative space. And the creative space is basically, we're all dreamers here at Hope Family Wines. And that's kind of how I've always to phrase it up. We want to dream things up, create experiences that are one of a kind that people don't get. So,
Example,
so we do a black glass tasting. You come in and you sign up for, but by the way, these tastings are curated. So you actually email the Dream Weaver at Hope Family Wines, or HF Wines, and they will contact you, they'll call you and talk to you and understand exactly who you are, what you like, what you don't like, and curate a whole tasting around this. There's multiple ones you can do.
So this could be a family, could be a corporate group.
Could be anything. Then once you nail it down, and they rotate throughout the year, there's three different ones that'll happen. So right now we have a black glass tasting, which is, to me, it's...
What's a black glass?
It's wild, and it's something you need to experience, because what happens is the glass that you get is mm-hmm. completely black.
So it's a blind.
Yep. You cannot tell what wine it is, what color it is. Mm-hmm. And what you learn out of it, we learn a lot of things, but it's competitive. It's fun if you're with a group. The way that our stewards go through it with you, they will tell you essentially what's in the glass before wine.
Description as to olfactory?
This could be this, yes. And it goes into the whole olfactory thing where they actually have, they'll bring out tasting wheels that will show you, you know, grassy or this or whatever. And it kind of points you towards a direction of what it could be. Then they bring out, like, what do you smell? And it's completely interactive, the whole thing. Mm-hmm. They'll bring out the little vials. This is what a currant smells like. This is what papaya smells like, etc. And so you go through this whole thing, and it's insane. Like, I've literally picked wine that I thought was a red wine, and it was a white wine. I mean, it just blows you away how much your vision presets the table for you before you even sit down. It's unbelievable. Mm-hmm. So we've got that. We've had a lot of success with the Austin Hope Cabernet, and we do a vertical of that multiple years. So the 2015 was the first vintage we did. You can taste 15, 16, 17, 18. And
side by side.
Yeah. Wow. And see how it's really gone through. Mm-hmm. What really got us started was Triana. Triana Red was our first real jump into thing, was 1996 vintage. And so we're tasting some of those wines back to like 99 and through. So it really gives you a whole different perspective of
things. That's really cool.
Yeah.
Better and better to a point.
Some of them do, some of them don't. Yep. But you get to kind of experience that and kind of walk down the lane. And our stewards are really, they're storytellers. So, I mean, you're not only learning about the wine itself, but you're learning about the history of our family, of the community, of how this region became. So it's really, it's a fun thing. And it's not a rushed tasting. It's as long as you want to be here. We don't book back to back. So your space is your space as long as you want. We have some amazing curated foods that go along with your tasting. So it's just it's a very unique, different experience that nobody's doing.
Let's back up for a moment. Cabernet Sauvignon, that's one of your specialties. That's what you're known for, isn't it?
Yes, for sure.
And sourcing, do you have a state grown and do you do a lot of contracting with farmers in Paso AVA and beyond?
We do. We have our state. Back up, when we got here in 78, my mom and dad planted wine grapes, so they were definitely early pioneers in the region. As we grew, we became farmers and sold our grapes to other wineries.
But your dad and mom weren't producing, they were just growers.
Right, and then we evolved into that.
Your dad was the first to start venting his own grapes, right? In the family.
Not really. He was part of it, but what transpired was we decided to build a bed and breakfast and a tasting room.
Where?
That's just off 46 West. It was called Arbor Inn. It's now Summerwood.
Oh, yeah, sure. That's a beautiful
place. So we built that in 87.
Nice.
And my dad put together a group of all the old early pioneers of the region and said, hey, I'm going to build this. You guys invest. And so we had like 16, 18 different people in the community that invested into this program. And the wine people that were invested in it, they made the wines from our grapes. So we basically did, it was a very mom and pop type situation.
And what did you start with? And that was your estate grown grapes, right?
We had some estate grown grapes there. We had vineyards because we had the West Side Vineyard where we live today. And then we had two or three on the east side of town. So we had vineyards kind of scattered all over the place because that's what our primary thing was. Mm-hmm. As that progressed, I was very interested in wine part of it, and my dad had brought his brother in. He was doing wine pushing. We were making bulk wine and selling it, and then we ended up meeting another winemaker from Napa Valley that liked the Cabernet we were making for bulk wine, bought it. We became friends, and over the time, it was Chuck Wagner from Camus. He had a Liberty School label, and that label, we started growing before it. Then pretty soon we were making it in Paso. Then pretty soon we were bottling it in Paso. Mm-hmm. I had started working for him in Napa and then at a couple other projects for him.
As a cellar rat, or what were you doing?
I did everything. I did as random as being a cellar rat to then getting on an airplane and going down to Hermosillo because he had a table grape operation down there and he wanted me to go down and look at that with him. And then be in Monterey where he started planting a vineyard there. So, and then I'd be with the finance people, and then I'd be with marketing people, and then one day I'd be with tasting room people, and then PR, and it was an amazing experience because I got to see so much of the wine industry. So as that transpired over time, we decided, why don't we take over the Liberty School label since we're already growing it, making it, bottling it, and we wanted to create a winery, which was Triana. It was a school in Napa Valley up there, and Chuck Wagner's father, that was back when his father was a child, it was around. Yeah. That's where that name came from. Brand was started in 1975. So we decided to put a partnership together and kind of dissolve the tasting room and all that bed and breakfast stuff and started our partnership, and we took Liberty School over, and we were going to start Triana, and my uncle was going to run that part of it because I was pretty young. My uncle passed away, and my father said, can you do this? And Chuck came and said, can you do this? And I said, yeah, why not? So I was 22.
No fear.
Yeah, 22, 23 years old, and went and hired, brought Jesse from the fields where I hoed weeds my whole life with, and I said, come on, you're going to learn to make wine. And then we just went at it, and I brought a salesperson on, and we started making wine and selling wine, and then now we've grown to a much larger scale. It's still a family operation, and it's pretty cool. But over the time, we had, to get to your question about vineyards and such, I joke about it. We got into the wine business the old-fashioned way. We didn't have any money, so as we were building the winery and buying tanks and barrels and growing, we started selling vineyards to afford to be able to do that because there was so much debt involved. So over the time, now we just have our estate vineyard where my parents live on. We live on.
How many acres is
that? It's about a 70-acre vineyard just right there. Amazing place to be that close to town and be on 70 acres.
Yeah. So going back in time, I remember interviewing a guy named Richard Smith that had Paraiso up in Monterey. Yeah, he was one of the pioneers of modern iteration.
100%.
And I said, dude, you know, you're one of the pioneers. And he said, yeah, we're the ones with arrows in our asses. He made a lot of mistakes. I mean, he had to rip out 20 acres of this and rip out 20 acres of that. Then the next guy comes along and thinks, you know, new square one.
Yep.
So since you've been going back in the day when Richard was doing his thing, mistakes. What mistakes did you make, and how did you learn from that?
I've made a ton of mistakes. It's a great question, Tom. Well, there's a saying that my father has. He's a quote guy. I actually made a book for his 70th birthday of 70 different quotes my father said.
Oh, cool.
And one is, don't believe your own hype. On the surface, it doesn't seem like much, but if you really believe or look at it and analyze it, it could be used in every decision you make in every single day of your life. I say that because you get going, you have a little bit of success, and you think you know what's going on, and you really don't. You know, we've almost been bankrupt while I've been running this company, and we turned it around, we learned from it, and we make better decisions. I think that's really not believing your own hype. It says so much to that. And the other thing I think we've done to learn from mistakes we've done is I listen. I'm a very astute listener to distributors, to consumers, to people around me, and then I'll make my decision based off of what I've heard. So where I think people get in trouble in this industry particularly is because of their ego. For whatever reason, there's a tremendous amount of ego in the wine business, and you cannot use ego. You know, we've made the wrong varieties. One thing we've done wrong multiple times is we're ahead of the curve. It's comical now because we've had success and the whole team. Because I think our tenure at our company is long. I mean, a general manager has been with us she was the general manager. She's now the vice president of the company. She runs the company, Gretchen, and she's been with us, I think, 25 years. Our head director of winemaking has been with us for 23 years. Our list, I mean, there's a slew of people have been working with us 10 plus years. So we've got an amazing crew, but sometimes I would come up with ideas and we would try and launch them. Like, tried to launch a box wine like 8 years ago, a premium box wine. Couldn't get that going. Now it's all the rage, right? And so we'd laugh about it. I tried to do the RTDs. We made a little thing called a Copa like 6-7 years ago, maybe longer.
What is that?
It was like the first really iteration of a ready-to-drink canned cocktail or canned wine, all of that. And I couldn't get anybody to go on. It was basically looked like a little tennis ball holder, and it would pop top like that, and we put one of our wines, Troublemaker, in it. And I took it all over the state, all over the country, and tried to sell that to people, and they're like, no, we don't see it. And now they're everywhere, right? So we've done a lot of
things. So timing is everything, isn't it?
Timing's huge. Yeah. We've launched a Merlot brand, did a whole national campaign, and literally that movie came out. Like the year into this whole campaign we did going off, and we were doing well with it. Candor was the name of the brand, and it was a great Merlot. And then Sideways came out, movie, you know, the quote of F. Merlot, and
that was really sad.
It's super sad. It killed that brand. We tabled that brand, and it went away. We struggled for 2 or 3 years with it, and I'm like, what?
We had any accidental home runs?
We've had accidental home run with the Graciano, a variety that we were not supposed to have. We planted it on our estate. It was supposed to be the Spanish clone of Mourvedre. It's supposed to be the Monastrell clone of Mourvedre from Spain, and it's a really special clone. Well, when they did the budding, there's also a variety called Monastrell, which is known as Graciano, and they budded the wrong thing. So we planted it, we grew it up.
And you didn't know?
I had no idea. Planted right next to a Mourvedre block in our ranch. And so we we looked at it, and I said, man, it sure looks different. It's very tastes different. The wine's different. The next year, I went to one of my neighbor friends, and Justin Smith from Saxum, and I called him, and I said, hey, I'm going to send you a ton of this new Monastrell clone. It's really weird. It doesn't taste like Mourvedre. It doesn't look like Mourvedre. He goes, I got that clone too, because there was only a handful of us in the very beginning that were able to get that clone. He says, I don't think it's Mourvedre. I said, I don't think it is either. So he sent it into Davis, and they DNA'd it, and it wasn't. So it comes back as this Graciano. Well, it took me, and I was so frustrated, right? And the nursery was like, well, you know, this and they're making, you know, but it's making good wine. I said, no, it's not making good wine. I'm having a heck of a time trying to figure out how to make this wine because it was super high in acid. It was black as night could get. I mean, so dark. Tannins, it had weird fruit flavors. And so we struggled with it a couple of years. And then we figured it out. I said, okay, we made a wine. I'm like, this is good. Let's see what we do with it.
So it was a blend that made it work?
No, we just started fermenting different and picking at different times, and then aging it differently.
So less sugar or more?
We picked it kind of in the middle, not over top ripe, but pretty ripe because we had to get the acidity down a little bit. And then we started using more new wood, which makes, doesn't sound right, but because new oak has so much tannin in it, but this had a lot of tannin in it too. So it's almost like a two positives make a negative. So we were hitting it with more tannin, more tannin, more tannin. And we were able to actually turn this wine into a lush kind of, but still a racy red.
What a paradox.
Super paradox. And we put it in our tasting cellar, and now we can't make enough of it. It's crazy. And so just.
How long do you barrel age it for?
That particular wine will be between 9 and 12 months. So that's another thing that's changed. You know, I mean, the wine industry has been.
That's pretty short term, relatively.
It is. It's something that we've really mastered because. For the longest time, there's so much smoke and mirrors and so much BS in the wine industry, right? There's so much romantic things that go along with it. And a lot of them aren't, they're not real, right? And we, like, I remember when I was young and traveling to sell wine, you know, nonstop, and it'd be like, well, how long is this wine age? And you, before it even came out of your mouth, you'd immediately say, 18 to 24 months. Even if it wasn't, it's right. Just because that was put in your head.
Mindset.
That was what you were supposed to do.
Right.
And we would age them for that long.
Well, that being said, what happens when you library it and just park it for a while in the bottle?
In the bottle, it just changes and morphs around. And
does it get better?
Hard question to answer because it depends on if you like wines with aged characters. That's another notion, right? It gets better with time. Well, it's like, no, the reason that was said is because in Europe, they could never, you know, mostly Bordeaux, for example, is really... Other than the soils, it's the wrong place to grow grape. They've got great soils, but the soils are man-made. I mean, they dug all that gravel out of those locks and made Bordeaux.
Interesting.
But the weather's always too cold, so you can never get these wines physiologically ripe. So they'd pick it very low. That's why the alcohols were so low and all that, because they couldn't get them any riper. Mm-hmm. Then you'd have to lay them down because they were so hard, so tough, and like that's why that term stopped.
Interesting.
But we spent a lifetime basically understanding tannins and how to make wines not only approachable, fresh, and youthful upon release, but still have enough tannin and structure to last 20 plus years in the bottle. So when you do taste a wine that's older, I mean, I enjoy them, but I always tell people, take a wine, if you're going to age wines, take one and age it for, you know, whatever, 10 years, and then take that one bottle to a party, or open that one bottle up at a party, and let everybody taste it. And then have another one of like the new vintage. You'll watch, most of the people, they'll taste it and say, oh, that's really cool. But then they'll go to the other one, the other wine.
Interesting.
Because they like fresh, bright, rich wines. Mm-hmm. But the aging, I mean, some of the, like, I mean, our 1999 Triana Red right now is a beautiful bottle of wine.
There's some crazy stat about when a bottle is sold in a liquor store or grocery store, statistically it's consumed, within 30 hours or something?
Oh, yeah. It's something like that. It's less than a day, for sure. It's not. I think it's like 10 hours or something like that. Mm-hmm. And now with twist-offs, you can go even faster.
That what?
I said with twist-offs, now you can drink it on the way home.
Yeah, for sure. So that being said, what's your total case production per year?
So our network's pretty big because, you know, we started it with a couple thousand cases in 1995. We now have... You'd asked about our farming. So we have a director of vineyards that works for us, Stacy. She's amazing. She's one thing on that note too. So we have 50 plus families that farm for us on a contract basis. And we work with them.
Stacy, pretty much all Central Coast.
Pretty much all Central Coast. Mm-hmm. Yep. We go all the way down to Santa Barbara and Monterey. Right now, we're definitely just coastal.
You're happy.
We're happy here, but I'm always pushing the envelope. Like, we just started putting stuff out in Cuyama. I mean, I love the region. I love the whole coast. Who knows? I mean, I do want to branch out and do other regions. I think, well, I take that back. We are making one now out of Washington wines. So we make a Washington wine out of the Austin label. And we're just selling it up in...
Pinot or what?
You know, it's a red blend. Cabernet, Merlot, Syrah. So the, you know, those Washington Mountains over there, they're more pronounced to the Bordeaux varietals. Mm.
So it follows that you can't sell everything locally.
No.
Have to distribute.
And we do. And that's part of probably, more importantly, what I believe in is the community and the region and Paso. Because I think Paso Robles to me is such a gem that I want to share it with everybody. Mm-hmm. So it's been my mission to get our wines tasted across the world, so much so that we have global people now. So we have two people that work for us in the export market.
So we you're selling in France and Spain?
Not France. Well, we actually, we are a little bit. Newest country was Armenia. We just went into there last week.
Wow.
So we're in 48 countries now.
Holy cow.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
Every state.
That being said, a part of being successful in distribution is a gimmick in the sense of creativity in the label and the name. Does Troublemaker fit in there a little bit?
That's what was my nickname as a child, because I was always in trouble. So that was that.
But nonetheless, it works. It does. Has that buzz in a grocery store or whatever, liquor store. It gets your attention.
It does. I mean,
it's like Sev and Deadly Zins.
Yep.
You know, the Mettler family told me when they first started making it, he said the wine wasn't that good. It was off the record. But it went viral solely because of the name.
That's funny. Yeah, we haven't had anything go that viral.
Well, but think about it. You go into a liquor store. How do you decide what you're going to grab off the rack?
It's extremely difficult. I think about that more than you can imagine, mm-hmm. because the consumers are the ones that dictate our success, right? Mm-hmm. And when you walk into supermarkets or stores, it's just like, wow, you're inundated. So, yeah, so label does have a big part of it. One of the things we've been very successful at is consumer trial. So we've spent enormous amount of money when we start with a brand to incentivize a restaurant to pour it by the glass. Mm-hmm. And through that, a lot of people, they get nervous and they don't want to do it because it's extremely expensive mm-hmm. to do.
Do you go on the road and do dog and pony show?
I used to do it nonstop. That's how we got to where we are. I'm mm-hmm. less now because we've got, you know, a sales team of 25 that mm-hmm. are across the country and other parts of the world. But yes, did a dinner last week in Kentucky. I'll be in Arkansas on Monday night.
Wow.
In Dallas on Thursday. So yeah, but I'm at a different level now. I did one 2 weeks ago for Phil Markert down in Southern California. He's in charge of all alcohol for Vaughn's Pavilions in Southern California. And he does these dinners because his wine sets in the pavilions and very amazing, beautiful wine shop inside a supermarket. He does these dinners where he'll invite the customers, and then they get to meet me, they get to taste with me, and we do a dinner somewhere down in Orange County typically. And those are well attended, and I like to do those because I do get to see the consumer and I get to talk to them and I get to mm-hmm. touch them and see, like, okay, are we doing the right thing? Are we going the right way? But the consumer trial is how we drive our success. We use extremely low sulfites. Our wines are the whole natural movement. I mean, to me, it's like, I don't know how more natural you can get. I mean, sulfur's from the ground, so. We put a little bit of sulfur in just to, you know, so that the consumer doesn't have a bad experience with a bad bottle of wine.
A grower down in Monterey or Santa Barbara County was talking about sulfites, and she was saying that there were more sulfites in orange juice.
Oh, 100% there is.
Yeah.
And if you eat any cider to dried fruit, like one of those pieces of fruit, probably more sulfur in that than you'll probably consume ever in wine.
And she was pointing out that paradox that people go, oh, I can't.
Yeah.
Because if I'm allergic right. to it, I go, well, do you drink orange juice?
Yeah. 100%. No, mm-hmm. it's a very true statement. So when the people get on these rants, it's just like, I'm like, no, we're not listening. We're making good wine, and this is how we do it.
Mm-hmm.
It is interesting. But we, you know, experimentation, we're constantly doing that. We just released a little wine that's very light Grenache, real low alcohol, like 9%, 10% alcohol. And then I wanted it to have a little spritz to it, you know? So we with our new equipment we have at our bottling facility, we can inject CO2. And so now, and then I said, you got to serve it cold. So it's this cold, light, mm-hmm. refreshing, like
great
watermelon, strawberry. It's just like, oh my God, it's so
that's
amazing.
A summertime.
Oh, it's awesome.
Yeah.
Pull out of the fridge, you get home, have a little glass. It's just, it's amazing.
Nice. And again, retail, where would somebody find your wines and what label?
So Hope Family Wines is the overarching company. We've got the Austin Hope brand, which is very well known for its Cabernet Sauvignon. It's done quite well. It was wine, the top 100 wines of the world 2 times. One was seventh, number 7 and number 10 1 year. Then under the Austin Hope label, we also make a Rhones of all of our estate. So Syrah, Grenache, Mourvèdre, Graciano.
And those are all Central Coast grown.
Yep. Majority of them are Paso Robles, and mm-hmm. and the balance is anywhere from Santa Barbara to Monterey. And then we also have the Liberty School label. These would be our national wine. And then we have Troublemaker. We have Quest, which is a great Cabernet Franc brand. We have Triana, our flagship, started, which we make Triana Red, and we make Triana Cabernet readily available.
In primarily Vaughn's or where?
Uh-huh. Yep. Yep, all those wines I'm speaking at are nationally. And then what did I miss? We had Troublemaker. So Liberty School, Troublemaker, Quest. A new brand we just released called Austin. A really interesting brand. If you go to a marketing school, they would tell you you're doing absolutely the wrong thing. But on the top label where the brand name should go is very huge. It says Paso Robles. And then down at the bottom in the corner, it just says Austin in very small, and then Cabernet. And we did that as a, again, for the love of the region, we're trying to push the region. I want everybody, my goal is to have Paso Robles is a household name, just like Napa is globally.
Was Paso Robles AVA always an exceptional wine growing region, or was there an evolution because of the injection of the thinking of the growers?
I think it's always been, the potential has always been there.
Because of the terroir.
Yep, because of the soils. Yeah. And that's another thing how special this place is. You know, we've not only do we have the Paso Robles AVA, but over the years now we've broken it into 11 different sub AVAs, which is amazing because it shows the diversity of what this region can do, right? Mm-hmm. We can grow Syrah, far west side, and it tastes a certain way. And then you go to the Chandon area, which is, you know, relatively not that far away.
Mm-hmm. You probably, even on your 70 acres, have different characteristics.
Yep, we do.
Yeah.
So it's really cool. That's what's great about it. So I think the AVA has gotten better.
Mm-hmm.
I think also winemakers have gotten better, growers have gotten better. One big initiative that we have, it's taken us 8 years to do, but we did it, and this was the first year that we can say it 100% now, is we're 100% sustainably grown.
Talk to us for a moment about that. What does it mean?
What it means is there's multiple things, right? There's and it's a good question because there's so many different platforms out there.
And that's a SIP certified? Is that
yes,
sit with that?
Exactly. So we're SIP certified, or there's another one that the Wine Institute uses, and it's very similar. But it really takes a look at the whole holistic journey of growing grapes and farming and winemaking and the human aspect of it is what I like about it. So it's, are you taking care of your people, right? So are you doing the right thing by them? Do they have health insurance? Are they taken care of? Do they have a livable wage? Do they have everything they need? Is their workplace environment safe? You're not using harsh chemicals. Use philosophies like, if I need to spray bugs, where are the bugs at? Okay, well, the bugs are in block 1B, only in this corner. So traditional farming, like the way I grew up, was we would nuke that whole place. We'd nuke 100 acres just if there was bugs in an acre. And now we go with different products, like stylet oils and neem, different things that are out there that you go and attack that little area.
And they're pretty benign, right?
100%.
Yeah.
It's a natural product. There's no chemical in it. Peppermint spray, all these different kinds of things you can use that, you know, are essentially organic products.
And how about introducing bugs? Like,
Was
that minute pirate bug?
Mm-hmm. Like, we actually, what we do is we have, we plant a cover crop around in corridors that encourage all these beneficial bugs that eat the other ones.
That's really cool.
Yeah. So being 100% sustainable has been amazing, right? So it's a, you know, and that goes into consideration of water. You don't need to use so much water. Use technology. Technology has been amazing for us in this industry. If you're ahead of it and you're in the game and not trying to be this old world, like, and I love the old world, right? But even the old world now is using technology. It's because you can be better and you can be more conscious and conserve more and all these things because they're there, right? Put a moisture meter in the ground. That tells you when to water. Not just like your grandfather said, why water when I see it needs water? It's like, well, maybe it doesn't need water. Maybe so being forward thinking, I think, is one of the biggest things that we've been aggressive at from the beginning. I think it shows to the consumers why we're having so much success.
That's really cool.
Carrying on with the sustainability conversation, why it's such a large undertaking is because you're dealing with growers and their sole livelihood is to grow a grape and get it to market, and they get paid. They get paid once a year. When we wineries, you know, there's always been a rib between wineries and growers. When it's time to pick, they want to pick. They don't want to be messing around, and sometimes we wait, and sometimes we'll say, well, they're not physically ripe, and then that pisses them off. So we've had this struggle over the years, but what we've done is getting them to get on this journey with us of making growing sustainable grapes. We've had to help incentivize them. We've had to show them. We've taken our state property. It's a fully regenerative farm, so we've gone to the next level. We've even gone farther, right? So now there's no tilling, there's all these things that we're doing that are very beneficial. So we've shown to our growers, look, it's possible, it can be done. Yes, it's more expensive, so we pay them more.
Mm-hmm.
And that's been the this struggle, right? So it's like, well, I want to keep spraying because that's what we do. I'm like, well, why? Because that's what we do. And I'm like, you know, that's what you've done. But Stacy's been amazing about educating them and showing them, like, I mean, just the tilth of the soils, like on places that are not being sprayed all the time, not being dissed all the time. And you can see like the whole soil comes alive. I mean, the microbes and bugs and all these things is happening. And so it makes the soil healthier. So you need less fertilizers. You need less different products that they put on all the time that cost more money. So in the long term, they actually will save money and make a higher quality product that's better for you. But it's challenging. It was a real challenge to be able to get that many growers to be, and we had to put a foot down. It's like, this is our initiative. And by 2025, if you are not sustainable, then you can't farm for us. So it was an initiative, but it's happening and it's cool. And I'm glad. And I think now the growers realize it, right? Everybody's more conscious, right? I mean, what we've done over the years, I mean, we didn't know things were bad, right? I mean, with different pesticides and different herbicides that were used. I mean, you know, I remember we used to use a product called Paraquat, which is basically, you know, Agent Orange, more or less what it is, right? And one of my dad's friends, his wife was spraying in the yard and she was in her flip-flops and she accidentally got some on her toes and all of her nails toenails fell off. And so she's like, this product might be really bad.
Learning curve. Yeah, Carl Winty said, if you don't have a sustainability model, you better work on an exit strategy.
It's true. So, yeah. I mean, you know, not getting people to think longer term and less, you know, short-sighted. I mean, my father's come around to it all, and he sees it, and he's as old school as it gets. I mean, you know, it's just...
For a moment before we go, in the growing world of grapes in California, there's some bizarro stuff going on, man. People reneging on contracts and price per acre, per ton, plummeting. What's going on?
Well, I think we've hit another one of our moments in the wine industry where, you know, it seems like it's about every 10-year cycle that we run into where there'll be too many grapes, or then there's not enough grapes. And we're in that cycle right now. And so, and then the other thing that's changed too is
but they're ripping vines out.
100%. Big time. And a lot of vines need to be ripped out. That's so some of it's positive, some of it's negative. Things cycle and varieties cycle. You know, core wines typically, you know, when like the Pinot was so hot there years ago, right? Everybody and their brother and sister planted Pinot. Mm-hmm. Well, then it gets to a certain point. There's only so much market you can have. And then when you speak to the dropping contracts, things like that, these are typically being done by large corporations that a lot of them publicly traded. And it becomes a commodity thing with them. It's like, okay, we make all this, we push as hard as we can, and then we can't sell anymore. Then we just bail out. Mm-hmm. We go do something else. And it's like, we look at it in a much more holistic scenario, right? We forecast 5 years what we want to do. I mean, forecasts are as good as you can be, right? But we're not perfect. But we don't try and just shove the market full of our product. We create products, and I think that's where you're seeing that. So, and then plus, you know, the consumption's down a little bit. But we've been through it before. We've been through multiple of these things. And I think you're going to wash out some of the folks that probably shouldn't have been doing what they were doing. Mm-hmm. Maybe get some better vineyards out of it. Maybe get rid of some wines that were not that great. So
to learn more about your world and parting thoughts,
hopefamilywines.com. you could see everything. Hope on Park is where we're at, and then our Triana Austinope Triana tasting cellar is off of 46 West. At Hope Family Wines is our social following, and dig in, check it out. Hope Family Wines, it's or austinhope.com, any of those will all find your way to our get on the journey with us.
Love it. Are you ever on the tractor?
I am. Not enough. I actually, it's funny.
You like that?
I do like that. And it's funny you bring that up. I actually have a conservation property east of here, brought back a bunch of wetlands that used to be there, you know, 100 years ago in the Central Valley. And that's about the only place I really get to drive tractor anymore. So I'll sneak off over there to the wildlife refuge and drive tractors.
All right. Austin Hope, thank you for the time. This has been great.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you, Tom.
I'm your host, Tom Wilmer, reporting from Paso Robles, California. We'll see you here. Everything's fine. All them cats is drinking that wine. Drinking that mess, their delight. When it gets drunk, start singing all night. Drinking wine, spoody, drink wine. Mop, mop.
You've been listening to the Lowell Thomas award-winning travel show Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer, a featured podcast on NPR.org's podcast directory. You are invited to subscribe to Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer on NPR.org, iTunes, and more than 20 other podcast channels around the world. To learn more about Tom Wilmer's journeys around America and the world, log on to thomaswilmer.com.
This is Roseanne Cash, and I'm sitting here with Tom Wilmer. Please support your local NPR station. I listen to WNYC in New York. In fact, NPR is all I listen to. If I didn't have NPR, I would feel like my lifeline to the world has been cut. So, yes, please support your local NPR station.